Welcome to Ascend Radio, where we talk about some of the biggest news and issues in regulation and digital government, as well as with the people with deep experience in those fields. I'm your host, Paul Levoy, and today I'm excited to be joined by David Benton. David has a storied career in nursing and healthcare regulation, and it's one that brought him from a tiny village in the hills of Aberdeenshire, Scotland, to the windy corridors of the big city of Chicago, where he now sits as CEO of the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, or NCSBN. David and I had a far-reaching conversation that touched on, among other things, the resilience of health systems, the incredible possibilities that new technology can and indeed is providing to health systems, and much, much more. So let's take a listen.
I'm all ready to rock and roll.
You're all ready? Okay, great. To start, though, for those who don't know, I'd love to hear you sort of explain what the National Council of State Boards of Nursing is and what it's all about, what it tries to do, what its mandate is.
Sure. So the National Council of State Boards of Nursing is an organization which will in fact be 45 years old next year. And we bring together all of the licensing boards from the United States, as well as obviously US territories. And we have overseas members in what we call exam user members. Those are people that use the NCLEX exam, and associate members. And those are licensing boards at jurisdictional level from around the world. So we have on the US side 59 licensing boards that are members of NCSBN, and on the international front, just 29. So it really provides an opportunity for licensing boards to come together, to learn from each other, to work collaboratively, and really set an agenda on the big issues that need to be addressed. And that's where we come in. We really work with our membership to provide solutions that solve real-world problems.
Going back to its genesis, was it created out of a need in the first place?
So, yes. Previously, the boards were being supported by the American Nursing Association. And obviously, there's a slight conflict there in that the purpose of the professional associations is to advance the needs of their members, whereas the purpose of the regulatory board, NCSBN, and indeed the boards at state level, is to protect the public. And obviously, those two can often complement one another, but they are quite different.
What are the key focus areas for the council today?
So we have a three-year planning cycle, and quite regularly, items will move across from one cycle to another, because the projects tend to be rather large in nature and long scale in their impact. So, for example, we've got some projects going at the moment on the what's known as the next generation NCLEX examination. So we have a computer adaptive testing exam at the moment, which is still considered as the leading premier exam globally in the psychometrics world. But in today's world, nurses are being asked to make clinical decisions like perhaps they have in the past, more complex, and be heavily involved in making clinical judgments. So we are changing the exam to emphasize the issue of clinical judgment as part of the process. So not only is the exam obviously legally defensible, psychometrically sound, but it'll actually reflect fidelity. So instead of just simply having multiple choice questions and different types of questions, we'll have unfolding case studies as part of that. That's one big piece of work. And that launches in April of next year. As a result of COVID-19, we identified that we needed to accelerate work on the development of a really robust remote proctoring system. None of the systems at the moment meet our specifications for security, etc. And therefore, we have a team working on developing a remote proctoring system. That's a 3-year project, and that's going really well. And that is a hybrid model between human proctors, but also heavily using artificial intelligence. And we can talk about that later, perhaps. We also have a number of projects which are really important in terms of public safety. We were first out of the box in terms of creating a mutual recognition compact. And back in 2015, we actually relaunched that program with more security features into it in terms of public safety. And we're doing extremely well with that. 39 states have, in fact, passed the legislation. So the compact will soon hopefully become a compact nation, which means that nurses will have a single license and then the privilege to practice in all other states. I think that's another very exciting piece as part of the development. Of course, we're just on the start of that for the advanced practice nurse. A couple of new things that are, I think, really important. We are seeking in the next cycle, which begins in October, to look at how we can support our members in reforming their licensing processes. In today's world, the technology has really moved forward dramatically, and therefore the ability to link data and to have a lifelong journey of information on a practitioner is very feasible, and we're looking to see how we might support the members in that regard. The other piece, of course, is that with the changing demographics, we're seeing the use of support workers far more than we have in the past, and we believe that they should be regulated, but not necessarily in the same way as registered nurses or licensed practical nurses, but they need to be regulated, and the data from that source needs to be connected in, because many individuals will go on and do nurse training. Or what we've also seen, which is worrying, is where a nurse has been disciplined, they will perhaps lose their license, and then they will go and seek a job as a support worker, often having access to some of the most vulnerable people in society. So we believe that actually linking that data sets are really important. We're doing some exciting work on developing an accreditation system for regulators that will enable them to really drive a continuous quality improvement agenda. And that's a very broad-based system which looks both internally in terms of the performance of their prime functions, but also in the governance space and externally as well in terms of how they work with stakeholders as part of that. And I suppose the final thing I'll say is that we recognise that regulators, they have some unique learning needs. So we developed a couple of years ago something called the International Centre for Regulatory Scholarship, and we've developed a whole range, suite of education that enables individuals to develop their regulatory skills so that we have a pipeline of regulators into the future. So that's a flavour of some of the stuff that we're doing.
That's exciting. So on the last point, does it work with sort of existing learning resources and seek to sort of connect them to incoming practitioners?
So we do use some existing resources, but we have been tending to develop specific materials for the regulators, because there's a particular perspective that is often missing in some of the available material. And again, that's been driven by the regulators themselves. They're coming to us and saying, you know, we have a lot of turnover in our discipline staff or in our licensing department, etc. Can you develop some learning materials for them And obviously that helps them to network with each other as well, which is really important in this highly mobile world that we now have, because, you know, nurses are moving around the country, and the connectivity between the licensing boards is enhanced when people are often learning together as well.
And back to the licensing of support workers, do we see any jurisdictions within the union or around the world where they have sort of equivalent licensing for that profession?
So this is the issue of to regulate or not to regulate support workers is very much alive and well around the world. And we've seen a lot of discussion on this topic. There are now just so many different names that are used for these individuals, and the scope can vary extensively as well. In the United States, what we're seeing is about roughly one third of the nursing boards have responsibility for licensing the support workers as well. But in the remaining states, the picture is very mixed, with sometimes the Department of Health, sometimes different agencies all being involved, etc. And all of that actually adds to complexity. So knowing exactly how many support workers there are even in the United States is somewhat of a challenge. We've done some work on this, and the best number that we can come up with is about 4.5 million, which is equivalent to the same number of nurses that there are in the United States. So it's a very large workforce, and with the changing population demographics, so aging population in the US with complex care needs, and a reduction in the birth rate, what we'll see is a tightening of the labour market, and really thinking about how this whole support worker continuum, right all the way up to advanced specialist practice, can really be facilitated is something that we're looking at as well.
And are you concerned at all about the, you know, there are lots of movements out there, pro-regulation, pro-deregulation. Are you concerned at all about some states, some individuals, politicians, whatnot, throwing their hands up and saying, wow, more another licensed profession?
Well, of course, there is regulation. And I didn't say necessarily that they were going to be licensed. I said that we were going to, a regulatory model that was appropriate for them. I think part of what, we've done quite a bit of work looking at things like sunrise reviews and sunset reviews. And, you know, part of the problem with the sunrise reviews is that conceptually it's a good idea, but no one up until this point has determined how you map the pyramid of regulatory intervention against the level of risk associated with a particular occupational group. So because no one's done that, you see some very strange anomalies. And certainly colleagues, economists in particular, have highlighted the fact that there seems to be over-regulation in some spaces. And of course, there's been a pushback to, we need to deregulate. Why do you need all of this when the level of risk is actually very low? So I think part of what we will be doing is looking at what is needed to protect the public, but doesn't inhibit mobility. And obviously with the concept of the Nurse Licensure Compact, we have a solution for that anyway. We just simply need to figure out how we can have a regulatory model and what's in that regulatory model, because we have a data system that it would enable the exchange of information in a transparent way, just as we have for the LPNs, RNs, and APRNs at the moment.
We've gone through some of the council's larger projects and work. What keeps you up at night these days? What sort of motivates you and is sort of concern?
Well, what keeps me up and what motivates me is somewhat different. But
right.
So I think one of the worrying trends that I'm seeing across the nation at the moment is the uninformed political interference that we're seeing within the legislative space. So we've seen a number of states pushing back on issues like practitioners who have been giving false information that do not align with the political ideology. And therefore, you know, one of the fundamental premises of any health practitioner is that you shouldn't do harm. Well, giving false information can often cause significant harm. And what we're seeing in a number of legislatures is politicians say, no, let the First Amendment rule the day. But as health practitioners, we have to tie ourselves to a much higher standard than freedom of speech. We actually have to make sure that we do the right thing for the population. So that's one area that is particularly worrisome. And obviously, recent changes around Roe v. Wade is another area where undoubtedly this will cause harm, and practitioners will find themselves in a real quandary about providing a service to someone that is in real need, but worried about the implications of that on their livelihood and indeed possibly their freedom as well. That's something that really does keep me awake at night. It shouldn't be, in my mind, it shouldn't be something that that should actually really ignore public safety that the politicians are getting into. The thing that really motivates me, though, is the fact that there is a willingness and there for people to collaborate and to really take a critical look at regulation. The regulatory model that we've currently got is really a model that was built for the industrial era, where people were, you know, they were born, they went to school, they got married, and they had their kids, and they died all in the same village. But nowadays we're highly mobile. We've got technology, and therefore developing a regulatory model that is aligned with a complex digital mobile world is for me the greatest thrill, because it really at this point in time we're designing the next generation of regulation for that kind of environment. And of course, United States, one of the wonderful things about the United States, and you know, it's both a blessing and a curse, is the fact that regulation is regulated at the state level. So we've got a natural set of experiments, and we can then compare how the regulatory model in one location either benefits or disadvantages, and we can then use that to actually help design you know, better solutions for the future.
Which leads us well into digital technology and its role with regulation and healthcare regulation. How are you seeing digital technology used in healthcare regulation today?
Yeah, I mean, it's been used in multiple ways, mainly to streamline and to facilitate a lot of processes. So what we're seeing now is, we moved away from pen and paper exams quite some time ago. We moved to computer-based exams. And what we're starting to see through some of our developments is many of the regulatory offices going paper light. I wouldn't say paperless, but paper light. We were working with one of the boards, and in fact, the U.S. Postal Service said to the executive officer, "Are you still in business? Because you know you're not getting any deliveries, very very few deliveries." And she said, "No, well, we've actually gone to a completely digital based system, so people can relicense, they can seek information through web portals, etc." So technology is facilitating access 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, it's not that long where if you wanted to know whether someone was on the register, whether they had a license or not, that you actually had to physically go to the Board of Nursing and actually look at the book. Now we've moved forward a long way, but now that information is not only available 24/7, but it's constantly being updated. Whereas before, it was, you know, once a year or whatever. So technology is certainly facilitating efficiencies and access to information. It also enables us to have a repository of information that can be a rich source in terms of looking at what works and what doesn't work, and to use that source to look at patterns over time, which can then inform changes in the regulatory process. So historically, about 25 years ago, 30 years ago, I guess, when I was the chief executive of the National Board in Scotland, if we wanted to look at patterns of things that we might need to change, we had to do all of that manually. And of course, the ability to do that manually takes a lot of resource, takes a lot of time, and it means that you're less agile than you need to be for today's world. Whereas, of course, now with digital technology, you can use artificial intelligence, you can use machine-readable capabilities to capture information and make it accessible to multiple team members at once and work simultaneously on issues as well. At the more practical level, what we're starting to see is the ability to identify and ensure that there is greater equity in the decision-making process, because you are able to track, you're able to kind of de-identify information and deal with the facts without any unconscious bias as part of the, you know, part of the process. So there's some real advantages to using technology on so many fronts that we see at this time.
Now, I know NCSBN has been very active in pursuing new AI projects around the world. What can you tell me about these projects, and what kinds of outcomes could healthcare providers and even the public see from these in the long term?
So artificial intelligence has enabled us to take a deeper look at many issues. Many of our boards were already using standardized approaches to ensure that there was consistency of decision making. So in their complaints process, they would identify what the findings of fact were, et cetera, and then they would map that to a tariff so that people would be dealt with in a consistent way. As humans, there's only so many things we can hold in our head at once and use. And of course, what artificial intelligence does is enables us to look at many, many, many more variables and to develop unseen understanding of how things can come about. So we've been providing some funding to some researchers that have done some collaborative work here in the United States with working with the Texas Board of Nursing, but with the colleagues in the United Kingdom, the Nursing and Midwifery Council there, and colleagues in Australia at ARPRA to look at how artificial intelligence can be used to identify the high-risk cases that need to be prioritised and move forward, how you can sort the intake of cases in a way that suggests the most appropriate way of dealing with that. We haven't gone to a totally autonomous system at all. It's still very much down to individuals to make the final judgment. But this enables us to really speed up the process quite markedly, maintain consistency, and also potentially generate much larger data sets as well to get some of those as yet unknown insights into what's really going on in the process. It's not artificial intelligence, it's some complex regression analysis we've been doing. But for example, one of the problems, one of the common complaint problems that come in to boards of nursing is diversion of drugs. And we have been able to get 16 boards to work collaboratively together to pool data in an anonymized form, but enable us to then identify what are the key success factors that need to be built into a alternative to discipline program. So if you do too much of something, there's no return on the investment. Once you get to a certain level, you will still have some people that will unfortunately not make a full recovery, and they will relapse. But really, once you get to that kind of break point, doing more isn't going to actually be beneficial. So therefore, what are some of those key break points in the various interventions? And we've been able to identify that, and we are able to use that and make suggestions to our boards in terms of how they can design their alternative to discipline processes that are going to maximize the potential of success. So that's another example. And I think I mentioned at the start, our work that we're doing on remote proctoring is a marriage between human proctors and the technology systems, because we do see the need to have a model in the future that isn't dependent on a physical location for testing, as an example.
Now, you mentioned OPERA, for example, and I'm sure your role in many ways is as much about looking cross borders internationally at what others are doing as it is looking inwardly at the U.S. Are there any cities, regions, or healthcare organizations, for that matter, within the U.S. or internationally that are demonstrating an exemplary use of technology, applied technology today?
So we're working. My chief information officer has developed a very close relationship with the health informatics nursing groups, and we've been using in partnership with a range of researchers in those groups our NCSBN ID number as a mechanism to answer some really, I think, interesting questions. So by embedding that number into the electronic health record, you can really get information which can be used to inform a whole range of things. So at the moment, we do a task analysis every 3 years to help us design the content of our exam. With a NCSBN ID number embedded within the electronic health record, with obviously all the controls that you need to put in, but it would be able to give us in real time changes that are taking place in practice, which can then inform the education community to change their curriculum to keep step with the changing demands and needs of the population. Whereas at the moment, with the best will in the world, education is always going to be dragging behind because the data that they get is, in our case, every 3 years. Well, that if you think about the changes that took place over the last 2 years, that's not good enough. What we can also do is, of course, at a regulatory level, we could look at the patterns of practice and map that to what is accepted best practice and then provide educational input targeted on the individual's needs. So, you know, if I think about what's happened over the last, say, 20 years, many practitioners are coming across individuals that have, chronic diseases, such as diabetes. The incidence of diabetes within the population has skyrocketed. And therefore, if you think about that, when you're interacting with individuals, historically, there would have been a main problem, but now we're seeing all of these comorbidities as well. And therefore, as those issues arise, again, it could be used to inform the provision of continuing education materials. Another way of using this data is obviously to seek information on what you're excellent at as well. So it's not just about looking for problems, it's actually about looking for, well, you know, who's the best nurse I have in my system that gets the best clinical results, and what is it that they're doing that's different from other folk, and how can I use that individual to perhaps promote excellence in practice. So it really is the regulator, the employer, the educator, all working in a much more collaborative way rather than in a way. And we've all got something to benefit from that.
Well, it's an exciting time for the intersection of regulation and digital technology in general. And you've outlined some ways in which it's employed now and some near future things. But when we think 10, 15 years in the future, when we think about the future vision of this technology-enabled healthcare regulatory world, what sorts of things do you see in the future that might be visible and practical for practitioners and for the public at large?
Well, first of all, the whole kind of simulation environment is going to be really accepted as a modality for providing people with relevant experience in a way that perhaps it hasn't been up until this point, and that will be augmented with a virtual environment where the mannequins, in quote mannequins, will in fact be more interactive. So at the moment we are at the stage where we can have a rudimentary interaction with a bot on the phone. We can get various things done, but those kind of features where our interaction with the mannequin will actually have the ability to basically have a conversation with the nurse, and so your ability to then equip the nurse with preparation before they go into the real environment, I think will be enhanced. The complexity of some of the simulations that we'll be able to run will be far greater than they are at the moment. I think one of the other things is remote access to services will continue to increase. Monitoring systems will become increasingly more sophisticated. We're already at the stage where technology can detect changes in gait and various other things. And if you have a rural community with a number of isolated individuals, elderly individuals perhaps, we could use that kind of monitoring to help prioritize visitation to families to see, you know, what's happening, etc. The other thing I think technology will enable us to do is to improve the quality of education, getting access to the leaders in the field, and the local learning environment will be more of a facilitator of learning rather than a deliverer of content. Content will be available in a way that it hasn't been in the past, and that's going to require some pretty big strategic shifts from our education providers to think about that, and indeed the financial models associated with it at the moment. Because at the moment, you know, having your students come through the door and pay their dues is how we get the money to run the education system. But in the future, it's going to be much more about a lifelong access to education. So, you know, in the past, I've done various things with the Open University, and I find myself still frequently going back there. And I'm not talking about doing full programs, but I'm talking about taking a module on a particular topic that meets my education needs at that point in time. So I think that kind of model will be more dominant. And then the whole issue of we're seeing baby steps to the idea of competency-based education, and that fundamentally shifts the paradigm, both in terms of how do you create a clinical team with the right set of competencies, rather than actually saying, well, I need two nurses, one doctor, one physiotherapist, etc. But what you actually do is you actually say, where do I get the competencies from? And it may come from a physiotherapist, or it may come from a nurse or a doctor, but it's a different way of thinking. So the whole workforce model we have to really redesign, because at the moment, the workforce planning is completely inadequate for today's world. We think about physical numbers within a physical space, and more care is being delivered remotely. And therefore, if I'm sitting here in Chicago, but all of the care that I'm delivering is in an intensive care unit in, let's say, North Dakota, then counting me as a resource for the Illinois area doesn't make any sense at all. So these are some of the challenges and opportunities that we have to address.
So I know research is so central to your activities and what you do at the NCSBN. In what notable ways is research informing decision-making and recommendations over there?
So, I mean, the Council's had a long history of research. Initially, a lot of that was focused around our exam development and systems development associated with that. Our research into how we construct data systems, the nurses system, which provides 24/7 information in real time. These were very pragmatic pieces. What we're now much more involved in is what are the things that actually make a difference. We're doing a lot more regulatory research into, as I mentioned earlier, what are the successful interventions for alternate to discipline programs? What are some of the evidence around advanced practice nursing, etc.? So we're really focusing much more on how we can make a difference both to the practitioner and their safety and their ability to deliver safe services, and also about making sure that people are fit for purpose as part of the process as well.
Is there any compelling data or any other data-informed recommendations from recently completed research or ongoing research for that matter that also comes to mind?
Doing on the next generation NCLEX is I think cutting edge. I mean, what it does is it first of all, it introduces a completely new paradigm in scoring. So here's the crazy way that testing takes place around the world at the moment. A multiple choice question. So let's just take it. You know, there are four options. one of them is right, but from a scoring perspective, the other three are wrong. You get 1 point if you get it right. You get nothing if you get it wrong. If the three questions that I give you, if two of those questions kill the patient and one of them isn't the best answer, but it's not going to do you any long-lasting harm, surely it's better that you give 1 point for getting it right. You get a half point for doing something that isn't the best option, but it's not going to cause the patient any harm. And obviously, you get zero for something that's going to cause harm or even a minus point. So using much more sophisticated scoring systems, we believe is going to make a difference in terms of improving the judgment and decision-making ability, because in today's clinical environment, nurses are key decision-makers. They are 24 hours a day observing pieces of information. They're assembling them, they're prioritizing them, they're hypothesizing what could be going on. They're taking different intervention scenarios and figuring out what might happen. So having a scoring system that actually fits with that scenario rather than it's right or wrong, I think is a major step forward.
And it seems to fit into the broader picture of what we've discussed before about quantifying risk in healthcare. Yes. Is that fair?
That's right.
Right. What else do you think has to be done in terms of quantifying risk in these practices?
Well, I mentioned this earlier, but I do think we need to be able to map the level of risk against the severity of regulatory intervention, so that we don't over-regulate, we don't under-regulate, but we actually do that. And you know, up until this point, we really have had, you know, some pretty basic tools. And certainly, if you read the economics literature, there's been significant criticism over the overuse of licensure with groups that really present no physical harm at risk to the patient, to the individual, the client, the patient, the whatever it is, the customer. So I think that is an area where we really need to do better, so that we don't over-regulate. We enable people to provide services, so have a return to the economy as well. So that's another area.
Before we wrap up here, I know you have places to be and things to do, but I wanted to go back to an earlier question about what keeps you up at night and the proliferation of misinformation, as it were. I mean, it's a challenge everywhere. Obviously, it's a challenge in healthcare. Maybe the million-dollar question, but have you, had any epiphanies or theorized anything on what the antidote is there in a context of healthcare?
So, we, to a certain extent, the terminology self-regulation has got some bad press because it's been conflated with the idea of the profession looking after itself. But for me, self-regulation is not at the profession level. Self-regulation is at the individual practitioner level. So I do think by spending some more time on equipping as part of basic education programs, that moral compass that enables people to do the right thing is part of the solution set for this. I would say as well, of course, that the this is not just a nursing problem. This is something that we need to get some of our politicians involved in as well. So I do think this whole issue of looking at what is the right thing to do, and holding at the front of your mind, if this was my mother, my wife, my child, what would I want done for them? And I think that is helpful in terms of at least making people stop and think a little bit more, rather than getting on a bandwagon and promoting information which is inaccurate. Educational programs have made a big difference in terms of stressing the importance of evidence and its use. Again, that's another component part of this. But I think it's also about people being prepared to stand up and talk out about some of these issues as well, and challenge the status quo where something is clearly wrong. I recall having a meeting with President Trump during COVID, and we were talking, and he was talking about in the early days that COVID, it's just like the cold. It's the same as the cold. And I said, no, Mr. President, it's not the same as the cold. At this point in time, the number of people that COVID is going to kill is significantly more than the flu, etc. And therefore, when somebody makes a statement that is wrong, stop it, correct it, and take action.
Well, that conversation you had with the former president, I'm sure could be fodder for an entire additional chat down the line. In any event, I want to thank you for your time today. I look forward to exploring other topics in the future, and wish you well in your ongoing endeavors.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed our discussion with David Benton. You can learn a lot more about him and the NCSBN's recent research findings by visiting Ascend Magazine at ascend.thentia.com, or you can click on any of the links in the show notes. You'll find there that we published a multi-part series on David and all the work he and the NCSBN have done over the recent years. And while you're there, I encourage you to join thousands of subscribers who have signed up for our Week in Brief, which is a weekly roundup of the latest news in regulation, professional licensing, and digital government. And also, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player. We have an exciting new season featuring many more interviews with preeminent voices in regulation from all around the world. So, till next time, stay safe, and thanks for listening.